Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm Jordan Maddox. Today I'm joined by Jose Salazar, a candidate for Fresno County Superior Court Judge. Jose is a senior defense attorney on the major crimes team at Fresno County Public Defender's Office, where he spent over a decade handling some of the most serious cases in our court system. He's a Central Valley native, born and raised in Sanger in a family of immigrants, who went from Sanger High School to Berkeley and then to law school at UC Hastings. This is the third judicial candidate I've had on the show, and I wanted to give Jose the opportunity to walk through his story and his judicial philosophy. We get into a lot of different topics in this episode, including why people become public defenders, what voters should actually look for in a judge, court backlogs, juvenile justice, and the one public policy issue he says sets him apart from every other candidate in this race. Let's go meet Jose Salazar. Infinite quests, investigating, making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best. Fresno's best. Jose, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
I'm going to disappoint you because my favorite place to eat is my house.
Okay.
My wife makes great food. She makes the best enchiladas. She makes the best rice. She makes great chicken parmesan and spaghetti. And I love to grill, so I'm always on the grill with the hamburgers, hot dogs, chicken, carne asada, tri-tip. And we have three kids, so everything's so expensive, it's probably best that we stay home with those. And I eat a lot of food, but having the three kids, kids are picky. So when we could all agree on a place, it's usually Red Robin.
Oh, so yes. Those bottomless fries. Can't go wrong. What is the key to a good enchilada in your mind?
Crunchiness. So that the top has to be a little crunchy. That's the way I like it. My wife has this recipe that was handed down to her. So it's just great. And she's perfected her rice over the course of our 20-year marriage.
Mm. I grew up with parents who would put enchiladas, and this is like a Caucasian version of them, in like these baking trays. And they would get pretty soggy. And then recently I've started to do my enchiladas like on a sheet tray where I don't stack them next to each other. And I cook them not compacted in a baking tray. And then when I put the sauce on top, it's like good chilaquiles, right? You should have a little bit of crunch and soggy. And it's hard to find that balance. We're going to dig into a bunch of different questions, but I want to start with giving you an opportunity just to kind of share your story of how you found yourself in the law. So can you chart your legal journey for when you first became interested in pursuing law as a career and how that led you to the public defender's office?
Well, sure. First, I'm born and raised in the Central Valley, born and raised in Sanger. I actually was born in Sanger Hospital back when these smaller rural towns had hospitals. And my grandparents decided to lay down their roots in Sanger. And I'm a family of immigrants, and I'm very proud of that. So I was born in Sanger, went to Sanger High School. In Sanger High School, I was in debate, and I also played high school football. So my wife cringes when I tell this story here because she's not a native of the Central Valley like I am. So she doesn't understand how big high school football is here, right? So one thing I like to share with people is I'm a high school football all-star and I won a championship ring. I was a Fresno B all-star in the first team. And when I tell those stories, she cringes because she thinks I'm trying to relive my glory days.
What position did you play, Jose?
Offensive line. Yeah. And my twin brother was a left guard.
Wow.
But he was not an all-star, which I remind him a lot that he was not an all. He claims he was second team. I think that's a fiction he's created in his mind. Yeah. And I did a campaign video where I showed off my championship football ring. And my wife said, never again show the ring because she thinks it's cringy. But I did my undergraduate work at Berkeley, went to school, law school at UC Hastings College of the Law. And I've been a defense attorney for over a decade. I'm a senior defense attorney at the Fresno County Public Defender's Office. I'm on the major crimes team. And being a public defender is really public service. It really is. We don't get to choose our clients. And public defenders are so important to the administration of justice. If you ask any judge, could the system run without public defenders? I would submit they would say no. So public defenders are critical and vital to the justice system. And I'm very proud to work with our great head public defender, Antoinette Taliak, our number two, Jason Sorensen. My chief is Angelica Rivera. All the chiefs at our office are great. And we have such great attorneys from across the board, from the misdemeanor team all the way up to general felonies to major crimes. But it's important to know, you asked me where I take clients. We don't get to choose our clients as public defenders. You know, we do this because we believe in the Constitution. We believe in due process. We believe in fairness. And that's just so critical to the system. And the system wouldn't, basically, it wouldn't run without us.
Yeah, right. Let me jump in real quick, Jose, and follow up. I have lots of friends who are lawyers in my life. What do you think is the commonality with people that pursue public defense attorneys? Does that attract people that are more passionate about social justice? Is there commonalities for the type of people that pursue this kind of work?
My life experience has a lot to do with it. Like I said, I come from a family of immigrants, and I think that the underserved communities are so important in our society. You know, it's the immigrant people that built the Central Valley, and I think that experience is important, and that's one of the reasons why I think public service is important.
Okay.
So,
I was asking maybe for you to extrapolate a little more broadly to maybe some of your colleagues, like why people pursue this particular, I understand your story, but when you look around your office, is it a lot of people that are focused on social justice and really have demographics and our socioeconomics of the Central Valley in mind in pursuing this career? Or is it just another slice of the legal profession that people pursue?
No, you definitely have to have the passion for it because it's a hard job. And like I said, you don't get to choose your clients. And a lot of times you may get a client that is difficult, understandably. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of our clients have mental health issues, have substance abuse issues. But I think public defenders are particularly good at seeing the person inside and looking at the big picture and realizing that a lot of these problems are systemic. If we had more, and this is more of a public policy point, but if we had more resources dedicated to substance abuse issues or mental health, I think there would be a lot less cases in the criminal court system.
Well, let me ask you this now. How do you know when you're ready for a position like that? Is it experience? Is it that you want to work in a different capacity within the criminal justice system? Maybe you can share your own story of how you came to the conclusion that you wanted to run for this office.
Yeah, I'm first and foremost, I'm qualified. I have over a decade's experience as an attorney, and I handle some of the most serious cases you could handle in Fresno Superior Court. But one thing people have to realize is Superior Court just doesn't deal with criminal cases. There's civil court, dependency court, which is CPS law, juvenile court, small claims, traffic court. And so, number one, I'm qualified, and I think that diversity and inclusion are so important to the bench. And that's just not a platitude. I think that my experience coming from a family of immigrants, I'm qualified to be judge. And let me just explain this with a story. One of the biggest changes in Fresno Superior Court has been recent changes, has been ICE agents in the courthouse. I'm in court every single day. Public defenders are in court every single day. And this is a reality. And I'm the only judicial candidate who has taken a public policy position on ICE agents in the courthouse. And my position is that it's a public safety issue because victims will be afraid to come to court. Witnesses will be afraid to come to court. It's bad for justice, and it's bad for the administration of justice, because when we start having access issues, when people are afraid to come to court, that's bad for justice. And I'm a bit surprised that there hasn't been more of a public policy conversation regarding this. And it is a complex issue, but maybe it is my background but I come from a family of immigrants. And frankly, this isn't a radical position. I'm taking the same position as the Chief Justice on the California Supreme Court. She has stated the same public policy position. Other judges in other counties have taken this position. And my point of view is, when people say I'm for justice for all and fairness, I think that applies to our underserved communities too. And those constituencies may not be powerful, but if you're for justice for all and public safety for all, I think it's incumbent to take the public policy position I'm taking on ICE agents in the courthouse, because we have to be as concerned for the public safety of the underserved communities that help build the Central Valley as we are about any other constituency or group. That's what justice for all means. That's what fairness means. It has to be fairness across the board and concern across the board.
I'm going to take a moment, and I'm a former history teacher, so I'm going to take people a little bit through the history of how we have arrived at a world where our judges are elected. We're one of the only advanced democracies where this is actually a practice. The founders of the United States actually preferred appointment as a method for selecting judges, but then that changed during the Jacksonian era, which is the 1830s to 1850s. And so basically starting in 1832 in Mississippi and culminating, I think, in 1912, right about during the middle of the Progressive Era, we see states slowly move to an election process. But then once we start getting the elections, the judges being elected, we have machine politics, we've got party bosses working to get judges elected, and that continued until the 1940s, when we start getting nonpartisan commission screens, different governor appointments as a different kind of process. But now let's jump to California. So in California, we Superior Court judges are elected in nonpartisan elections for six-year terms, but in practice, most judges first reach the bench by a gubernatorial appointment to fill a vacancy and then run as incumbents in the future. Most of the time, incumbents are rarely challenged and almost nearly never defeated. When you look at it from your vantage point, what are the pros and cons of having an election-based court judge system?
You brought up history. This is a very, this past election cycle was very unusual in that there were seven judicial offices up for election. Now, why were there, and this is my understanding, I'm not a historian like you, but this is my understanding researching the issue. There were seven open judge positions because my understanding is that the judges retired and simply didn't file for re-election. So if a judge retires in the middle of their term, the governor is able to appoint someone. If a judge simply doesn't file for re-election, that triggers an election. Am I being clear on that? Or
Yeah. No, I know it's inside baseball, but yeah, I think I'm following.
It's inside baseball, but it's important because this election cycle was it was unprecedented. And if you look at the media coverage, Fresno B, they indicated that this election cycle would change the composition of the court, and it was also unprecedented. And based on my research, in the past 30 years, there's been about, and I'm not perfect, I'm not a historian, but I think there's been about eight contested judicial elections, and there was seven in one cycle here.
Yeah. And so I've heard some theories from different people in the legal community what was going on there, but we don't have to go down the speculation route.
No, and that's improper. I will not go down the speculation route. That would be improper, and I don't do that. But I'm just simply stating facts here.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important for people to realize what and how unusual this past primary season was. And that's, you know, one of the reasons I decided to enter the race, because from my point of view, I thought the people, Fresno County, needed a real choice in this election. And let me tell you something, it wasn't easy. I know nothing about politics. I was the judicial candidate with the least amount of money raised. However, we did make it past the primary. There was three candidates in my race, and we were able to make it past the primary. We were outspent 10-1, and it's not easy. It's not easy on the family. It's not easy on my three kids. I've been married for 20 years. I have three kids. I have a 11-year-old, an 8-year-old, and a 5-year-old. And being a dad is one of the great joys of my life. I love being a dad. I love being with the kids. I try to be the best that I could be. And I have to be honest here, when I was thinking about whether to throw my name in the hat, I was very nervous about it. I was very apprehensive about it. But I always tell my son, you got to be brave. And I just thought that it would be disingenuous for me not to, you know, be brave in this situation, because I do think that my experience and background would benefit the court. And I think that the judicial races, there needed to be more of what I say is a real choice.
Yeah.
And so we're back. We're back in the general election now. We did well in the primary with very little money, working very hard. But it's a big thing to do. And I didn't have a campaign manager in the primary. I tell you, my wife is my campaign manager.
There you
and
go.
She doesn't do politics, but I she's my campaign manager, and she's still my campaign manager. And I think she's good at it. And she told me, I would never do this for anybody but you. So,
yeah. No conflict of interest at all there, Jose, that you're married to her. Let me ask you one more kind of general question before we go into the specifics, because there's lots of technical questions I want to ask you about our superior court system and how it can be improved. But generally, let's say you're just a public defender living in Fresno, you're not running for superior court judge, and there's an election that comes around, and you are looking at two candidates from the same profession as you, but you're not in the race. What are the kinds of things that you would be looking for between these two kind of anonymous candidates for judge? The scenario I'm creating. Are there certain things that you look for? Because I've had a number of people reach out to me and say, I don't know how to decide between these two people. There's not a ton of information. They both seem legally qualified. Like, what kinds of things do they look for? Like partisan politics, it's a little more simple. There's parties involved. But this, local elections where seemingly you have two very similar candidates running for a judge seat that maybe people don't fully understand what is entailed. What kind of things would you recommend?
I think one important indicator is the kind of endorsements one accepts.
Okay.
In this past election cycle, local politicians, who in my view, for no apparent reason, just for political gain, attacked, in my opinion, the LGBTQ plus community. And as someone who wants to be judged, someone who's going to preside over cases, not just criminal cases, but other cases that affect all walks of life, I think it's important that when we say we're fair, when we say we're for justice for all, and that we'll follow the law no matter what, I wouldn't accept endorsements from politicians that, in my opinion, attack other groups of people just for the sake of attacking other groups of people. I think that's one indicator. Experience isn't always the best indicator, because I could say I have 20 years experience, but if I do 3 cases a year, that's not that many cases. I always joke with people, public defenders, we have, I call it dog years, basically. Like, we do so many cases that 1 year as a public defender is many years for a regular attorney. But I think I would look for the threshold of experience. I have that. I would look at the types of people that are endorsing a candidate, and I would just look at their experience. I think that your personal life experience is important. When I first started to run, I said, listen, I'm a working class, I'm a family man, I'm a common man. And the reason I said that is because, and I always, this is a theme in my videos, I'm not an insider. I never claimed to be an insider. I don't have connections in the court. I don't have connections with local politicians. And I'm not an insider, but I think that we need that sometimes. And for example, I think ICE agents in the courthouse is an issue that should be addressed. I think that not addressing that issue, being silent on that issue, is sending a message, frankly. I think silence on the issue is sending a message, because Fresno County is majority minority, and the Latino population in Fresno County is substantial. I believe it's over 50%. And this isn't just an abstract kind of thing. If you're connected to the community, like I am, you know that people are afraid, and we shouldn't take that lightly.
All right, let's jump into some more technical questions about your role as a Superior Court judge. Trial judge's world, and these are questions I've asked the two previous candidates I've had on, but I want to flesh out your approach to it. A trial judge sits in an intersection of three major domains. One is applying the law. Another domain you could call exercising discretion, so judgment, and then managing the courtroom. You're also the courtroom manager. When those three variables or factors in a courtroom are pulling you in different directions, as they sometimes can, how do you decide what takes precedence?
First, you have to have courtroom control. So I did as a public defender, I did a domestic violence assignment. So I'd get there at 8 o'clock in the morning, about 8:30, the whole gallery was full. There was people outside the courtroom because there was no room in the courtroom. And we were there until 6:30 at night. You must always be professional, because you have to understand that as a Superior Court judge, you have to operate by a higher standard, okay? Because you're in a position of power. And so temperament is so very important. And that's, being a dad really teaches you how to be patient. It really does. And being a public defender teaches you how to be patient too, because you get there at 8 a.m. and you're there all day. You're talking to clients, you're talking to the district attorney, talking to the judge. But in my experience, staying even keeled and always just taking it moment by moment and not losing control was so very important.
Robert Sapolsky published a book a couple years ago called Determined, which looks at free will versus determinism and like where human behavior exists along that spectrum. Are we fully in control of our actions? And so that's just one example of many areas in science where our understandings of how the human brain are evolving over time. And so I'm curious, when you are dealing with a case where the controlling precedent seems out of touch with some of our more modern understandings of the facts, whether that's forensic science, whether that's addiction, whether that's adolescent brain development, like how are you going to handle those cases where you feel like perhaps the precedent is attached to a former way of understanding the world or science or the human mind?
So, number one, public safety is so important. And I would always have public safety paramount, because a judge, it's incumbent on the judge to consider public safety. Number two, judges must follow the law. And I will follow the law. And if judges do not follow the law, then they are appealed. And so in terms of discretion, I think a judge's role is important. I was child's attorney in dependency cases, which is CPS cases. I was child's attorney in delinquency cases, which is juvenile cases. And I found that I appeared before a very good judge, and he really wanted to rehabilitate the kids. And that's so very important, because as you indicated, a juvenile's mind doesn't fully develop. I believe the science says now it's 26.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
Yeah. And California has codified that for judges to consider. It's that a minor's mind doesn't develop until in their early 20s. And this is also important to me. I think my life experience as a public defender, how substance abuse really impacts people's lives. And it's a shame. It's a shame because it costs between $30,000 and $50,000 a year to imprison somebody at the state prison. And a rehabilitation program is a fraction of that. And I have so many clients that have mental health issues. And they come in, for lack of a better term, they're acting kind of crazy. And a month or two later, I come see them, right? They've been taking some meds, and they're completely different people. And this issue of mental health is important to me, because my 5-year-old, He is a child with special needs. And he's fortunate enough that my wife saw about 2 years old, hey, I think he may be having some issues here. Let's get him diagnosed. Even though for her, it was very tough to get the diagnosis that he was special needs, because in many ways, there was a mourning period for her, like a loss of what his life could have been. And it's just a process that parents go through. But my point is, we were good parents. We identified the issue. We confronted the issue. And he's on a great track now, and he's doing very well. But a lot of people don't have that advantage. And, you know, sometimes there's not much you could do as a judge. If a person doesn't want to rehabilitate, if a person cannot rehabilitate because they're just not ready to kick the drug habit, or they're not ready to take their mental health meds, there's only so much you could do, because public safety must be considered, and public safety, it's a strong consideration. And hey, look, I'm a dad of three, okay? I'm concerned about public safety, believe me. I want safe neighborhoods just like everybody else. But I do think that my experience does give me an insight that will be valuable as a judge.
All right, let's talk about bureaucracy now, which is everyone's favorite subject. Backlogs in the criminal justice system are a primary source of a lot of people's complaints, and judges can have a major impact on either increasing the backlogs or decreasing them. So I just am in the middle of a new book that came out last week called The Time Tax. It's by a journalist named Annie Lowry, and it looks at how the government systems, when they're too slow, effectively are a tax on impoverished people's lives, because they have to spend so much time trying to keep up with the system so they don't either fall between the cracks and don't get the benefits, or miss important windows, like say in the criminal justice system, so they make sure they don't deal with consequences that maybe they wouldn't deal with if they had the time to keep up. So I guess my question to you is, how do you think about the causes and solutions to backlogs in the court system?
A lot of it is an issue of resources. There are a lot of great programs, a lot of, I think worthwhile mandates from the court of substance abuse treatment and the like, but those mandates are not sufficiently funded, which affects the effectiveness of those programs. And so I think that getting more resources from the state to fully finance those programs that are supposed to rehabilitate people is so very much important. Judges have to be good stewards of the taxpayers' money. That means running an efficient calendar.
Let me jump in real quick, Jose. Yeah. I'll give you a specific situation within this. Continuances are a common thing, and they're often agreed to. What will be your general approach to handling continuances with attorneys?
Is there a good cause for a continuance? How old is the case? If a case has been continued for 4 years for no good reason, that case must be set for preliminary hearing, it must be set for trial, and there must be good cause. And that's one thing a judge can do, is make sure, keep track of cases, make sure cases are being resolved effectively. But at the same time, a judge must consider fairness and due process for all parties involved. So judges also try to resolve cases. People may not know this, but the majority of cases, and this isn't just in Fresno County or California, but across the country, they resolve. In other words, plea deals are taken. It's relatively rare for a case to go to trial, and a judge can be very helpful in trying to resolve cases, and that could also lessen the backlog in court.
Yeah, how do you prevent coercion, though? If you pursue efficiency, that can encourage more plea deals, but sometimes those plea deals or settlements are not in the client's best interest. So it seems like it's a kind of a balancing act, right? And trying to move the court forward, but also giving people the opportunity to pursue a trial if they feel like it's needed.
My public defender alarm went off, right? So whether to take a plea is solely within the discretion, or it's the sole decision of the defendant. That's one of the decisions they get to make. Defense counsel can advise on strategy. But in terms of whether to take a plea deal, that is totally up to the defendant. Now, I could advise and say, I think that this is a good resolution. I could advise and say, I don't think this is a good resolution. But it's your constitutional right to take a case to trial. And there is no, I don't see coercion, okay? In terms of judges trying to resolve cases, that's just trying to get the parties together and see if there is a middle ground that can be, that can resolve the case. But as a public defender, I could tell you that no good defense attorney will ever try to make, for lack of a better word, make a client take a deal that's unconstitutional, and that's a violation of the rights and the Constitution and due process that we fight for.
Yeah, I think when I was referencing coercion, I wasn't referencing explicit coercion, but pressure, which pressure can function that way, and it's implied coercion. Let's jump to a different subject, homelessness. How do you think about how you should handle homeless cases in Fresno County going forward, given the move that politics has made?
So I can't specifically address that issue because that may be a case before me. However, I think that homelessness needs to be addressed on a public policy basis. I think that all the stakeholders in the city and the county, and I know resources are limited, but there must be a consensus, a bipartisan consensus to address this issue, because the criminal justice system is one method, or that's one part of it, but we can't ignore all the different aspects of government that can help reduce homelessness. And so the only thing I'll say about it is I think that there needs to be more of a public policy push to address the issue on a bipartisan basis, because no one likes homelessness. No one likes to see unhoused people. And so I think that's one thing that everyone can agree on.
Let's talk about juvenile justice now. Juvenile justice has been in the news media recently with the Caleb Quick case, which is dominating local news in Fresno. But I want to ask you more generally about your philosophy around this. We just talked recently about adolescent brain development, and adolescent brain development is not necessarily one of those things that is a gradation, but can be. Does the seriousness of the offense change how much weight you give to the defendant's youth, or do you just consider youth as a constant when you're looking at these cases?
So there's a whole area of law that a judge must apply in this regard. And so in the case you're referencing, that judge applied the law. But I think it's important to consider the whole body of law. In other words, let's not take one case and apply it to the whole area of juvenile law. I don't think that helps anybody. And the facts of that case, you know, it's a sad situation, but, and the case is getting national attention, but I'm reluctant to try to take one case and comment on a whole area of law.
Yeah, I was just more referencing that because it's on people's mind and thinking about how we apply law to juveniles, and if it's truly justice, if their brains are still under development, and how much we should consider their youth as a variable when we're considering whether someone should be moved to adult court or the sentencing and et cetera.
Yes, and so the judges in this case applied the law and ruled. If you're asking more of a public policy question, that's for the legislature to decide. Judges, we're the third branch of government. We apply the law. These public policy questions are more for the legislature. But if we're going to talk about legislation or future legislation, I just hope that we take a look at the totality of juvenile law and be a little reluctant to just look at one case and apply that across the board. Because I could tell you, when I was child's attorney in dependency and child's attorney in delinquency court, which is juvenile court, it was so great to see kids who are rehabilitated, kids who took advantage of the programming, kids who became productive members of society, because in the long run, that saves the taxpayers money. If we could intervene and save a life and produce a productive member of society. That saves us $30,000 to $50,000 housing that person in state prison. And as child's attorney, was so great to see children who were rehabilitated. And that's what I like to see. I really can't comment on the specific case you're talking about.
I don't need you to. Absolutely. Yeah. I was just bringing it as a reference point as to why it's front of many of your potential voters' minds as they're thinking through who they want to elect to judge, thinking through how they would treat children in a court setting. And I'm not asking you for public policy. I'm asking you to understand your judicial philosophy as how you would approach these cases.
Yes. My understanding is that the judges in this case applied the law, and I don't think anyone questioned that. I think both sides conceded that the law was followed in this case. Mm. I think that's so very important. That's what I would do. I would follow the law.
Yeah. When you're thinking about transfer factors, degree of criminal sophistication, whether a minor can be rehabilitated, prior record, circumstances of the offense, when you're thinking about all those factors, when you're considering a transfer, are there certain ones that carry more weight for you and why?
No, all factors must be considered, and we have to look at each individual on a case-by-case basis. And of course, the severity of the crime is one factor. And the law prescribes exactly how to apply these factors, and that's what a judge must do in that situation.
Okay. To close, Jose, why you're the best candidate for this role, and we're going to close with book recommendations.
Okay. Well, I have my platform is that diversity and inclusiveness is very important to the Fresno Superior Court. You know, Fresno County is majority minority, and I think that it is important that the bench reflect not just racial diversity, but economic diversity and diversity in families with children with special needs. I think that perspective is so very much important. But I want to make it very clear that I am qualified to be judge. I handle some of the most serious cases you could handle in Fresno Superior Court, over a decade's experience. And when I say I'm for justice for all and fairness, those aren't just platitudes. Because from my point of view, if you're for justice for all and you're for fairness, then you will address the public policy issue of ICE agents in the courthouse, because that's affecting our most vulnerable communities. And I'm the only person, the only judicial candidate speaking out on that issue, because justice for all and fairness, they're not just abstract concepts to me. Coming from a family of immigrants, seeing how the community is afraid, I'm concerned about access to the courts. I'm concerned about the public safety of victims. I'm concerned about witnesses being afraid to come to court. And I think that I had the courage to speak out on this issue. And it's not an easy thing. Okay. From my point of view, or from where I sit, I don't think anyone has spoken out on this issue. But I'm in court every single day and we see it. And so I have the courage to not just say I'm for fairness, not just say I'm for justice for all. I have the courage to take a public policy position on public safety, on ICE agents in the courthouse for our most underserved communities. And those underserved communities may not be powerful constituencies, but they help build the Central Valley. And this is something that should actually bring us together. One thing that should unite us is agriculture. One thing I'm so very proud of, my grandma came to Sanger to work, and she took pride in the fact that she was the fastest worker in the cannery she worked at. And I love that. That hard work, that ethic to better yourself and work hard, that's what the Central Valley is about. And that's what agriculture does for the Central Valley. Whether you worked in the cannery like my grandma, or in the fields like my parents, or in the packing house like I worked in, or you own a farm, or you're in marketing for the agricultural industry, agriculture should bring us all together. But I'm here to say that justice for all includes the underserved communities and fairness includes our underserved communities, our vulnerable communities.
All right. To close, Jose, I ask every guest for a few book recommendations. What are a few books you'd like to recommend to listeners?
To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. Okay, that's probably on every attorney's book list.
Is Atticus a good lawyer?
Atticus is a good lawyer in my mind. He's such a good lawyer that my youngest, my five-year-old Emilio, his middle name is Atticus.
Really?
So his middle name is Atticus. And the second book I would recommend is In Cold Blood by Truman Capote. Mm. Now, if you're into those crime dramas, those true crime novels, In Cold Blood started it all. So Truman Capote, he came up with this concept of the nonfiction novel. And an interesting bit of information is Harper Lee, she hadn't written To Kill a Mockingbird, but she was Truman Capote's assistant while he was researching the subject matter of In Cold Blood. So if you're a true crime person, read where it all started, In Cold Blood by Truman Capote. And of course, To Kill a Mockingbird, if you haven't read it, you should read it.
Okay. To close, Jose, if people want to find out more about your campaign or attend an event, what do you have for people to look at and where can people find you at future events?
We have a fundraiser Wednesday, September 9th at Summer Fox Brewery in the Tower District. And that's from 5:30 to 7:30. All ages are welcome. My children will be there, so please come. You could find me on social media. We're very active on Instagram and Facebook. Jose Salazar for Judge. It's all one word. So Jose Salazar, and it's F-O-R, Judge. And we're also on the web, www.josesalazarforjudge, and that's F-O-R.com. But social media is where you should follow us. And yeah, I'm asking for your vote November 3rd.
So. Fantastic. Jose, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me, and good luck this fall in the election.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, consider giving us a rating and review. It goes a long way in helping others find the show. We'll see you next time.